Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about Ready Player One. And with me today in the shed is...
Ty. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Ty.
How are you?
I'm very excited because I've been waiting for this episode of the Cosmic Shed for some time.
Tell me why.
Because I loved Ready Player One, the book. It was like a shot of just pure joy every five lines with some reference to something that I loved from my childhood.
Can I immediately upset the shed right now? I wasn't a major fan of the book. I thought it was quite... I mean, let's whisper this.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite badly written.
It's a good job he hasn't said he'll do an interview, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean...
Hang on, Ty. Listen, I'm shocked. And we're going to have to come back to that. Ernie, if you are listening, ignore Ty. I loved the book. Steve loved the book. Maddie's loving the book. And I've been on a bit of a nostalgia trip ever since I read it. Playing classic games and watching 80s films. Steve and I watched a few films together, had a few 80s games nights. And finally being able to see the film and it not be a disappointment was just brilliant. Now, Ernie Klein didn't reply to our request for an interview, but Andrew Popplestone did. And Andrew Popplestone spent a good portion of last year making Ready Player One the film. When Wade puts on those Oasis goggles and the Oasis opens up, all those stunning visuals, taking you on a tunnel through 2001 and all that, that's Andrew Popplestone and the guys at Territory Studios. You'll probably remember that we spoke to Territory Studios about their work on Blade Runner 2049. And we'll hear from Andrew later in the podcast. And we'll also hear from... What, Ty, where did we go the other day?
We went to the MCM Comic-Con in Birmingham.
We did.
And we met two actors who actually spend their entire careers playing online avatars. So I'm quite a big gamer. One of my favourite franchises is the Uncharted games, which is like a modern-day Indiana Jones with Nathan Drake. The star of that franchise is Nolan North, who is massive in the world of gaming. He does voices in most computer games, but he is probably best known as being Nathan Drake. Troy Baker, likewise, is also a voice and performance artist and has appeared in games like The Last of Us, which was a wonderful game if you never played it, and he was in Uncharted 4 as Nathan Drake's brother, Sam.
And here's just a snippet of what's coming up. We asked them if they would like to be involved in the film if they ever actually get round to making the film of Uncharted.
With Uncharted, I think it's how movies are made with, you know, movie stars. It's not, could I do it? Yes, but at this point, I'm also getting older. I joke about it that, you know, by the time this is made, I could play Sully.
would you do Sully if offered?
Sure. No, but, you know, but the thing is, it's like, as far as I'm concerned, I've made four movies. Like, you know, I mean, the way I look at it, and as an actor, I'm actually looking for the next thing. I want to. What's next? What's fun? I've played that. I've done that role for so long, and it's kind of. I would do another one, but it's kind of like Harrison Ford. He has nothing to prove as Indiana Jones.
Right.
But they throw a truck of money at him.
And we get the crystal skull.
He's going to get, or whatever it could be. But, you know, it's a great answer to, you know, just see what someone else's take. I know the last talk was Tom Holland as a younger Nathan Drake. If you're going to do it, I would definitely do somebody younger. So that if it does become successful, it can sustain a series of films. It just would be, you know, nobody wants to watch me run around like that. I don't, especially me. I will say this. I still think it's a better idea to take movies and turn them into games.
Hell yeah.
Than do the other way. I don't know why Hollywood's gotten this
annihilation.
I've said for a long time that The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I think, would be a phenomenal game.
Heck yeah.
You have a great female lead character, strong, and I will work on my accent and play Michael Blomqvist, because that I could do, because He's of that age.
Much more from them later. But first, Ty, explain yourself. How does someone like you come to not utterly love the Ready Player One book?
Andrew, as you know, I'm a bit of a nerd.
Yeah.
I like my geeky references.
Yeah.
When it's a geeky reference every other line, and you feel like the author is just putting them in there as if to kind of make some sort of in-joke, and when one of the challenges is having to recite all the dialogue from War Games, quite frankly, you've gone a little bit too far.
Strange game. The only winning move is not to play.
I loved the War Games section in the book just because it made me go back and watch War Games again. We then did an episode on War Games.
It's also Monty Python, isn't it? He's also got to quote along with Monty Python.
Yeah, it does. But the way that they did that with The Shining in the film is brilliant. I love that.
Very well done. And considering it's The Shining, I was like, this is bold. You're immediately going to be terrifying half the audience.
Come out, wherever you are.
I love nostalgia. You know, when they're making a new series of Thunderbirds, I'm going to watch it. When it's an entire book or film dedicated around essentially a very specific type of nostalgia, and it is kind of pop culture from 1975 to 1991. You know, the kind of stuff that we all grew up on. Me and you, middle class nerds. It seems that, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the film. It was good fun. It's not without its problems, which I'm sure we'll get into. But it is a very niche slice of pop culture. There's no kind of, dare I say it, African-American culture in this. It is a very white man's look at pop culture, which, as someone who grew up on all of Steven Spielberg's films, fine.
Yeah.
I get it. But in itself, it's problematic, if you kind of get where I'm going.
Okay. What I'll say is I think you're right. In that respect, I think you're right. But it is an homage to a time when that was a thing.
Exactly right. And it is essentially a big 1980s tribute version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
Kid with a dream has to find the golden ticket or three keys to inherit the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah.
Essentially. The fact is, Parzival, or
Wade,
in the book, is an insufferable know-it-all. I recognise myself in this. In the book, he knows everything to such a degree where you're like, you need to get out and feel the touch of a woman or a man. You just need to get outside, sir.
Yeah.
In the film, I think Steven Spielberg, talented up-and-comer. I think he's got a great future ahead of him. I think he recognises this and tries to make Wade less annoying, and also kind of highlight the dangers of wanting to spend all your time in an online world, which is something that the book doesn't address, I feel. It kind of makes out that everyone spending all their time in an online world is great. You can go to school there. And it has all these benefits without kind of really addressing the fact that this is terrible for humanity, because if everyone's online, they don't care about the real world. They're not fixing the problems. And it's the same thing in the film that, yep, they switch it off at the end on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but you don't get the feeling that anyone's really addressing the bigger problems in the world. It's a world rife with poverty and inequality, but no one's really addressing that. All they care about is what their lives are like online. And I feel Spielberg may have been turning his eye to that and might have kind of be trying to trick us all into thinking that we're going in for this big family adventure where people are riding DeLoreans and you can throw in the Iron Giant and King Kong. I think he's trying to say something in the film that Ernest Cline was not in the book.
Do you think it's not said in... I think that's kind of the point of the book, isn't it? Apart from all the nostalgia, I think the point of the book is... But this is all great, okay, enjoy this, but also get out there and experience the world, because that's what it's about.
That's true.
Well, I listened to the audiobook, which is read by Wil Wheaton, which adds another level.
Never heard of him.
Another level of wonderfulness.
You're probably wondering what happened before you got here. An awful lot of stuff, actually. Once we evolved into humans, things got pretty interesting. We figured out how to grow food and domesticate animals so we didn't have to spend all of our time hunting. Our tribes got much bigger, and we spread across the entire planet like an unstoppable virus. Then, after fighting a bunch of wars with each other over land, resources, and our made-up gods, we eventually got all of our tribes organized into a global civilization. But honestly, it wasn't all that organized or civilized, and we continued to fight a lot of wars with each other. But we also figured out how to do science, which helped us develop technology. For a bunch of hairless apes, we've actually managed to invent some pretty incredible things. Computers, medicine, lasers, microwave ovens, artificial hearts, atomic bombs. We even sent a few guys to the moon and brought them back. We also created a global communications network that lets us all talk to each other all around the world all the time. Pretty impressive, right? But that's where the bad news comes in.
I haven't talked to anybody about it, so I don't know if people, and I haven't looked online. I've disappeared.
I think people seem to enjoy it.
Okay.
But I think people are very much aware of certain issues. Essentially, Wade wins the girl by just being a massive treasure trove of geeky knowledge. I mean, as real to life as that is. the whole thing about Samantha. I mean, in the book, an avatar that he falls in love with, and it's revealed she has kind of a disfiguring, you know, birthmark. But by then, he doesn't care. He wins the girl through, you know, being awesome. In the film, Samantha has a very slight birthmark that you really wouldn't notice. But I like the fact that Steven Spielberg gave her more to do than she does in the book. And I think that's why I preferred the film much more to the book, where everyone is just kind of caught up in Wade's adventures, and it's how Wade, through being a massive walking geek encyclopedia, saves the day. In the film, everyone seems to live in the same city. Which is, but I like in the film that it's kind of like, you know, if you fail to pay your credits in the Oasis, you essentially end up in a life of servitude. Essentially, yeah. Became like an online slave. I thought those aspects were more interesting in the film.
Yeah. Okay.
In the book, I felt we're just rushing along to our next Amiga reference. I had good fun with Ready Player One, the film. I just feel that the inherent premise of it is problematic.
Okay.
If you explain the premise to anyone, it's weird. But it's because Mark Rylance was very adorable in the film, playing himself as kind of an on-spectrum introvert who wasn't like a psychopathic Mark Zuckerberg or a Bill Gates. You actually kind of felt like, oh, this guy can't talk to people. I get why he created this online virtual world, unlike Mark Zuckerberg, who was just trying to rate women online and ended up bringing down democracy. You kind of let a lot more go.
Yeah. Okay, right. I think you're probably right, but I went into it invested in the idea that this was just a trip down memory lane.
Yes. Oh, don't get me wrong. I had a lot of fun with it. Yeah. And I was just there looking, spotting all the references. And it was a big nostalgia fix that was injected straight into my eyeballs.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, I think I love the film. What I think is really brilliant is how different it is to the book and still totally part of the same thing. But I don't judge this film in the way that I would judge Passengers, for example, or that I would judge a Star Wars film, or I would judge a Star Trek
season. Can I say something about Passengers very quickly?
Yeah, go on.
that film only works because of the charm of Chris Pratt. Because it's Chris Pratt, you let a lot of things go. If his character was played by someone like Steve Buscemi, it's the creepiest, most terrifying film ever.
Yeah. Even with Chris Pratt, I think it still is. It's more creepy because it's presented as okay.
It's adorable.
Yeah.
Even when, yeah, I mean, if any of you haven't seen Passengers, we don't want to spoil it for you. There is a decision that is made in that film that is absolutely reprehensible. And granted, the casualty of this decision holds a grudge for a long time, but eventually is won round by essentially Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's astonishing. I said this at the end of our last episode. Don't watch Passengers. Watch Orbiter 9 on Netflix, a Spanish language film. Anyway, listen, enough of all that. I think you're a bit harsh on the book. I think it does do some of the things that you say it doesn't, but it doesn't matter. One thing we both agree on is that the film is a hell of a lot of fun and looks amazing. He won't thank me for saying this, but a big part of that is Andrew Popplestone. As you'll hear, Andrew and the Territory Studio guys had a lot of creative input into the film, and I joined them in their studios the other day, along with Steve. And the other voice you'll hear is that of Willie Runt, a photographer and a friend who just happens to live round the corner, so joined us for his Cosmic Shed debut. We started by asking Andrew exactly what he had done for Ready Player One.
Because it was kind of like two shows, so it was all post-production, so unlike Blade Runner, which was on set. On set screen graphics and playback. We came in post, and we were initially briefed by Adam Stockhausen, who's the production designer. And as you know, there's two worlds in Ready Player One. There's the real world stuff, and then there's the virtual reality. And Adam asked us to essentially come up, devise a graphic language that kind of knitted everything together. You know, when you're interacting with the technology and the Oasis, what does that look like? What do people's HUDs look like? What does it look like in your visor? What does it look like when you're scrolling through and looking for a weapon or a piece of, you know, clothing or whatever? And then everything else that bleeds out from that, how do you knit this together for one holistic look? And especially there were lots of shots in the film where you kind of cut from real world to the virtual reality, the Oasis counterpart, and there's a simple little graphic element between the two which kind of helps blend them together.
Okay.
Yeah. It certainly helps the storytelling anyway.
So you literally get the film or sections of the film.
Yeah.
And then you have to.
Yeah. So in the really early stages, we got this huge dump of, I don't know how many shots. I mean, we worked on 265 shots altogether.
Right.
And so we probably got all that, all these blocks of sequences, and they've all got code words and code names and all the rest of it, which you have to learn. You're kind of speaking in tongues half the time. And you kind of would go through those, and those are just sort of reference. Some of them might be, so obviously there's footage plates that were shot for real world stuff, and then previs, super rough like block stuff from ILM of the animation. You know, super sort of janky, but it's quite funny to watch. And from that, we then start to try and work out where our graphics might go, what's needed, and the kind of work it will be. And then we'll start to kind of pull together a bit of a plan, working with the visual effects producer and visual effects supervisors, and Adam and the production team as well.
Yeah.
And then slowly work out from there what's the best approach.
Yeah.
And this was a really tricky one because there was these two very different worlds and two very different executions. So it was logistically it was a bit of a nightmare, but you know, it was super fun.
How long did it take, the whole project?
So we started very beginning of February and we didn't finish until November.
Right.
It was supposed to finish in May.
Yeah.
So it turned into a bit of a monster.
Yeah.
10 months, I think.
So what's the process that you go through? You talked about designing a visual language, and I imagine you have a lot of influences. I've grown playing a lot of different computer games and a lot of different, and there's stuff that's sort of recognisable and familiar if you play computer games, and there's stuff that's totally new because it's a a different interface to what people use.
That's exactly it. Once we started to work out, hey, the different sort of graphic areas we'd want to look at, okay, we need some HUDs, we need visors, we need screens here. Oh, there's this thing called the curator and he needs like a look and blah blah blah, and oh, the DeLorean needs a HUD, that's cool. But when, you know, when we start to try and plan that out, but we broke it down into two very simple areas, which was GSS, various systems, blah blah blah, simulated systems, and IOI. And we thought those are the two main areas we want to tackle design wise so that's where we started conceptually, and we started to just throw down a whole bunch of ideas. We need HUDs. How does that look? We need it in a first person POV. We need it in a third person POV, because when we're in the Oasis, you know, we're actually seeing these animated, completely animated CG characters, and their HUDs pop up, and we're kind of in this third person perspective, which hasn't really been done before. Mm. Like, what the hell? How does that look? And then how do you interact with it? So it was these things we started to sort of flush out, and we put together a whole bunch of different ideas. And the kind of initial direction from Adam Stockhausen was, we want to nod to the 80s and try and get in some of that kind of nostalgic vibe, but it needs to look super, super sophisticated and futuristic at the same time, which is pretty cool. So, we've got so many nerds here, and everyone's just geeking out on, you know, how we can drop in little sort of graphic nuances and blah, 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 and we're all listening to 80s music for a month, and, you know. So those first few weeks, we just threw down loads and loads of ideas and flushed them out. And how retro do we go? How, you know, do we? We had some like looks that looked super arcadey, and others which were like much more kind of 8-bit. But then, you know, how do we make that futuristic and sophisticated? And Adam saw them, and I think we had about 8 different ideas, concepts, and he was like, "I want them all." Mm. Okay, well, we can't. Can't do that. What do we do? Yeah. So I thought, okay, why don't we actually brand our characters, or allow the characters like the ability to kind of reskin their stuff? You know, like, do you remember MySpace?
Yeah.
You know, when you're able to kind of reskin MySpace and have music and different colours and fonts and maybe a logo and stuff. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if you could do that for all the GSS characters, all the different Gunters? Yeah. So I asked Adam, you know, is that a cool thing? He was like, yeah, do it. So we started kind of working up different logos and brands. That's why Parzival's got his the sword through the Z, and Artemis is like kind of like super 80s vibey, like punky, and H is like metallic and like brutal. And then kind of working with like colour schemes and different fonts. And all that
were you responsible for that part as well? For that?
Yeah. We drove with all that. It was really cool when all those logos went on the different posters and stuff as well. And it all somehow really tied in with their persona, because that was a chance for us to try and reflect their character through the design of their HUDs and what have you.
Yeah. And what does that character do? So you like read the book cover to cover, and then you also get direction from...
Generally, so we all read the book. Some of us have read the book beforehand, and some of us did a quick read. But in terms of direction, so there's Adam Stockhausen, and then the visual effects producers as well. So we were working, and touching it before, it was almost like two shows, because we had the real world, and we worked with Digital Domain and the visual effects supervisor there, Matthew Butler, and Industrial Light and Magic and the visual effects supers there, Roger Guyette and Grady Kofer. Grady was in London and Roger was in San Francisco. Matthew was in LA and the production was in LA as well, so we'd all get on this like big CineSync calls, so all different times, like time zones, and it was crazy. And Adam would be in the call sometimes as well, and Adam would come up with some ideas, or generally it was just, hey, not to the 80s but sophisticated, and then we ran off, did concepts, presented them, and then we start to develop. And then when Roger and Matthew came in was when we start to get more shot specific direction. So it was very top level at first, and Adam presented our sort of developed designs to Stephen after maybe a month or so, and he really liked them, so that was like the big sign off. So right, yeah, right, cool, we're good to go. And that was like a real...
Yeah.
How did you sleep the night before?
Oh man, I when I got that email, and the morning I woke up and first thing in the morning got the email, he loves them.
Yeah.
I was so happy. Like relief, but also like that is, you know, that's kind of like a career moment right there.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
So and then we started to work through, break down the sequences and the various shots. How do we apply our designs then and flush it out? And that's the harder part. And how do we start working out what the IOI stuff looks like? And because then you break IOI global design over the war room and the urology department and the Sixers and, you know, and all that stuff. So what does Sorrento's look like? What does he look like when he's in Mechagodzilla, you know? And that's when we start getting into the kind of the nitty gritty of all the shot stuff.
Cool.
Does the whole office get a shot of adrenaline when Steven Spielberg says you're on the right track?
Pretty much, yeah. Kind of do a quick shout some of his feedback. Yeah. So whenever we do send off a big delivery for a Steven review, because Roger or Matthew would present our work to Stephen, because Stephen was either at Amlin in LA or he was on his yacht in Italy or something.
Sure. Yeah.
So, and then we'd get notes back the next day and we'd see all the notes that kind of applied to us. I'm like, graphics look great, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, you know, so yeah, everyone would get a huge boost from that.
Cool. Did you see some notes of things other people were doing that you didn't like?
Occasionally. But I mean the thing is with Stephen, what I learned personally throughout this whole process was that he always just boiled it down to the story, you know. And what's interesting, what we learned as designers, because we were there trying to make this thing the most beautiful thing ever and trying to work it into the story, but you know, sometimes over designing something and he'd just be like, he'd look at it, and if the idea didn't land instantly, he's like, it just doesn't work. There's no let's try and work it this way. It just doesn't work. If it doesn't support the idea instantly. And it was a really interesting learning curve for me to understand how he looks at things, you know. And oftentimes it's just all boiled down to the story, and just to simplify things, nail that story point and then like develop it from there.
Yeah. Did you enjoy the film then when you watched it?
Oh man, I loved it. Loved it. I was, we went for a cast and crew screening at Leicester Square, in the Odeon Leicester Square. And I was sat between Sam, who is the lead artist on the project, and my girlfriend Zara. And Sam and I were just like, the whole time we're like, oh, what's this one gonna look like? And Zara was just like, shut up. She was like more excited, the whole, you know, because I just wanted to make sure everything looked okay.
Yeah.
And then it looked even better than I could have imagined.
Yeah.
And so then I could just kind of sit back and enjoy it.
Do you feel like when, because we normal human beings are waiting for this film for a long time, and it's just kind of really hyped up. Do you think the hype is even bigger for you because you're in it, or is a little bit like, I know kind of the...
It is. You're massively, because, I mean, it essentially took over my life last year. But going to watch it was just really lovely to see it looking as good as it did, and I was absolutely thrilled with how it looked. But also it's just that it just underlines the project. It's just a nice sign off, and you can go, okay. You know, because there's also a point where, you know, you deliver the work, and it's normally, I mean, like with Blade Runner, for example, it was almost a year, we finished it a year before it came out. Yeah. So you almost forgot about the project, which is stupid to say, but you almost forget about it because you're running on to all the next ones. You know, all of a sudden I was then working on Ready Player One.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh God, Blade Runner's coming out next month. You know, and then, so we're working on another couple of projects, and so you sort of forget about it slightly, and then it's like, wow, Ready Player One's happening. Oh, God, my dear. And then everyone gets hyped up again.
Had you read the book before you knew the film was coming out?
Yeah.
You're a fan?
Yeah. I loved it. I know they changed it a lot, but I kind of really like what Stephen did with it. I think he simplified it in the right ways.
I think it was a really strong adaptation. There were a lot of changes.
Yeah. What did you guys think?
I really liked the book, and I was really down with all the 80s gaming references and things because I grew up with that. And I think it was the best adaptation they could have done. I think if they'd have tried to stay faithful to it, it would have missed a lot of the market that it's hit really well. And it wouldn't have been the right film. I think there's definitely, like, people should read the book, maybe before seeing the film, maybe after, because there's a lot that both add to each other. The fact that the author was deeply involved in the movie production was a good thing.
The pacing was incredibly different
in
both, and I think the pacing was brought, was changed in the right way for a film adaptation.
When we spoke to the guys in the territory for Blade Runner, and they told us that they were working on Ready Player One, that was the moment that I was like, okay, it's going to be okay. Sorry, you shouldn't really hear that, but
no it's amazing.
I just, you know, I loved the book. Well, I listened to the audio book, right?
That's cool.
Like, Will Wheaton chatted to me about the 80s. It's pretty cool, And, and I absolutely, there's like a shot of pure nostalgic joy every five lines, basically. And I was like, how on earth can you do a film? How could you make
There's only one man who could have done
No, absolutely. And only one studio who could do the on-screen.
What's your retro gaming experience?
My gaming life started with Sonic the Hedgehog on the Mega Drive, and then it was like Nintendo, and then the Super Nintendo.
Also, you didn't stick with that. That's a one from Brazil, and there's a big rivalry between Mega and Mega Drive and Nintendo. Swear to Mega and Sega, whatever. So you went.
I was the flip flop between the two. No problem.
But I
lied to my friends. I didn't quite get it. I'm of the right era for the film and the book. I'm 34, so you know, I did all that stuff, but I didn't quite hit the Atari and any of that super early stuff. But you know, everything after that.
My one criticism of the film is there isn't a really like 15-minute sequence of them playing Joust.
I was just thinking that could have been epic.
I thought through the film that it's a shame with rights and things, because you can't obviously have all the characters that bring your childhood back to life, so you wouldn't be able to obviously have any Star Wars kind.
The rights thing was crazy, because there were quite a few sequences we were working on where, like the urology department, for example, and we kind of designed this whole big database for the urology nerds to be sifting through all the time, and there was these images going up, and we had to work with Warner Brothers' legal department, and there was so much back and forth. Alex, the line producer here, just had a nightmare going, like, working out what we could and couldn't use. Stephen was trying not to reference any of his stuff as much as possible. You know, I was like, I want to get Breakfast Club in there, and I want that, you know, I want certain bits and blah, blah, blah. So we all had like a wish list of little bits and bobs we want to try and get in. But there was what we could get hold of, what we were allowed to do. For some reason, we couldn't get a lot of Star Wars stuff. which is a shame.
I really wanted to see like a bit where R2-D2 is DJing.
When I reached the bar, I ordered a pan-galactic gargle blaster from the female Klingon bartender and downed half of it. Then I grinned as R2 queued up another classic 80s tune. Union of the Snake, I recited, mostly out of habit. Duran Duran, 1983.
R2-D2, DJing in Gravity Free Disco, is the only time I'm going to dance.
Yeah.
Apart from my wedding day. And it wasn't in the film.
But I don't call that dancing, sorry. I was there.
The Shining stuff is amazing.
How they did that. Making magic, that is.
That must be bizarre.
There's a nice, if you go to Cinefex, they're going to have a big article coming out, and I think the ILM guys talk a lot about how they did that. So that's worth checking out.
So what are you doing now? So you spent a year on that.
What we're doing, we've got loads going on, it's bonkers. We've got a couple of films, again, I can't talk about anything specifically, but we've got a bunch more films coming on. Some post VFX work, some on set. We worked on the Pokemon film as well, which is going to be quite interesting. We've done a whole bunch of crazy experiential stuff as well, which, because I don't know if you know the studio, we work in like games and experience stuff and commercials and the rest of it. We're actually doing title sequences for a whole bunch of films, and I'm doing a whole bunch of stuff for Sky Sports as well, which is quite fun. Like some this really kind of crazy frame by frame stop motion, not stop motion, cell animation.
Can you tell us a bit more about the experiential stuff?
Last year we worked on this there's this crazy billionaire who's bought a mountain in Austria, and he's I shit you not he's bought a mountain in Austria and he's making a Bond exhibition in this mountain.
What?
Right, it's yeah, fantastically true. And so we've come in to kind of create all these immersive graphics and design the kind of motion graphics throughout this exhibition.
What?
Yeah, and then there's another guy, another seemingly bonkers chap in New York, who's created another spy exhibition in this building in New York, and there's this huge lift. It's called Spyscape. And this lift takes you up to the exhibition. And the lift is probably about the size of this elevator, I should call it, the size of this room. We can fit 50 people in there. And we've created this immersive 2-minute piece which takes you through kind of not just the history, but a whole kind of bonkers kind of background in spy. And it's kind of like this Willy Wonka type thing. It kind of takes you up out the world and around. And
we need to take the shed to those.
Things.
A Bond exhibition inside a mountain. Is it focused on Bond villains? Because that's exactly
No, it's the whole sort of Bond. It's Bond everything.
But he thinks he's a Bond villain, right?
I mean,
yeah,
must do.
That's cool work.
If there isn't a rocket with the top that comes off, then it's a trick.
That's a really wide range of work.
Yeah.
From the virtual and the pseudo real in movies to the real world. Is there a lot that translates?
Yeah, because I guess what we're really good at is not, you know, we've got the design side, but there's the narrative, the story, and then the technology. And we marry all of that. So everything we learn in storytelling from film, we can then take into, you know, commercials or experience or, you know, anything else. And we combine that. We love using technology in kind of new and innovative ways.
Yeah.
So combining all that together is our little sweet spot.
Yeah, yeah.
How much of what you do is informed by or maybe even influences real-world user interface design?
Well, a lot, actually. We've got a studio in San Francisco as well, and they work a lot with a lot of the tech companies out there, because a lot of companies come to us and they see the work we do on films, like The Martian, for example, especially the kind of more real-world stuff. There's the fantasy side as well, but the real-world stuff, they come to us and say, hey, can you help work out our user interface? You know, might be like NASA, for example, comes and says, you know, can you help us develop our interface after seeing our work on The Martian? Or various other tech companies in around there, and car manufacturers will help us, ask us to help them flush out the user interface on their dash, and you know, and that sort of thing. Because again, it's storytelling.
Yeah,
both in terms of the utility as well as the aesthetic.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the utilitarianism, you know, on The Martian. It had to be as true to real life and how it works as you know possible. We worked on a film last year, which is coming out this year, called Hunter Killer, and it's got Gary Oldman in it and Gerald Butler and blah blah blah. And it's about subs, nuclear submarines. And we had the director wanted, again, it's all on set stuff, and they built out this amazing kind of set for the submarine, and there were screens everywhere, but he wanted it to be as true to real life as possible. So we had this chap from the Pentagon who who was like an ex-sub-commander, and he was our liaison, and so we were working with him to just make these scenes as real as they possibly could. Cool. And they're like absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
They're working screens, essentially. Awesome. Which is quite cool.
Can I just check something? Did you just say that the NASA watched your stuff in The Martian and then wanted their stuff to be based on that?
I think there was a conversation had. Again, I don't know how much I'm allowed to say.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it's that that happens.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And security, we're just growing and growing and getting bigger and bigger all the time, which is incredibly exciting.
Cool. So how did you start?
The studio.
Yeah.
So Territory started back in 2011, I think. And it's David Sheldon Hicks is the founder. He somehow, in fact, he knew he got onto Prometheus. He was asked to design the screens for Prometheus, and that was his first job.
Amazing, right?
Prometheus, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, what a first gig, and that's it. I think the very first project for Territory was a games project, and David was freelancing at the time. He was like, yeah, I'll do it, and he sort of set up Territory. Mm. And then Prometheus came along, and then grew out from that, and Guardians of the Galaxy, and Avengers, and Zero Dark 30, and various others. And so that was the pedigree. It was always, you know, it was on-set screen UI. And then since then, we've sort of branched out into much more visual effects-based stuff, and we still do the on-set stuff, but much more post and title sequences and visual effects and games and commercial and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Mm. What is your favourite one to work on from start to finish of the films you've worked on?
Blade Runner was special. That was a special project because of the work we did, but the people we got to work with, and the way in which we got to work. It was just fantastic. Ready Player, and that will always hold a special place in my heart, but I think Ready Player One, because it was such a beast, and it did really take up such a huge part of my life. Mm. That's probably going to be the big one so far, cool. I would say.
Cool. So far?
Yeah.
Well, that so far makes me happy. Please carry on working on the films that we love.
We shall try.
Thanks so much to Andrew and everyone at Territory for talking to us, and of course for all that wonderful work. Don't forget, you can hear our episode with Territory talking about their work on Blade Runner 2049 back in the Cosmic Shed archive. But Ty, we met Nolan North and Troy Baker at MCM Comic Con in Birmingham.
And when we met the two gentlemen, we were surrounded by a bunch of other journalists. So you might hear us trying to field questions amongst a rabble. I personally wanted to ask Nolan North about how he ended up in Star Trek Discovery as a bridge officer on the USS Vengeance. Apparently, it's because J.J. Abrams is a big Uncharted fan and he just did it as a favour. but yeah, so this is our interview with two people who play computer avatars for a living. So enjoy.
This is more press conference than Trump has done.
Will you tell the truth?
Listen, this guy over here, the truth, what is the truth? I don't understand the truth. What are you, the truth?
It's fake news.
All right. It's all fake news. You're all fake news. Look at these guys back here. Look at these guys. They're going crazy back here, these guys. I say these words.
How many porn stars have you?
Silence. That's the funny thing. He will talk about everything as he did, but you bring up one porn star, he goes, I mean.
You give one porn star 130 grand. What is she going to do?
It's all fake news. How can we help you, gentlemen and lady?
Welcome to Birmingham, guys. Well, basically at big Comic Cons like this, you guys have done so many franchises like Last of Us, Uncharted, Assassin's Creed,
Burger King, McDonald's.
Of course, the big ones. Which fan base is the most passionate at these things? What are you mobbed by? Which fans?
Man, the most passionate?
He was just almost attacked by Last of Us fans, cosplayers.
It felt like I actually had like clickers behind me that they were. I don't know. It's I think everybody who has the volition to pick up a controller and actually spend 30, 40 hours or more playing a game is a pretty passionate fan. Even more so than like film or sometimes even TV. But I think it's varied. I mean, we've definitely had success with Uncharted. That is something that has, it changed the game.
Yeah, for me, the answer is Uncharted.
I mean, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's more, you know, men, women. I met grandparents dressed like Sully. The whole family comes. There's Sully. There's, you know, it's you know, it's something that's gone on for over a decade. So that's, and I've done nothing else. That's why that usually qualifies it as the top one.
So is game VA work very different to when you're doing advertising or audio books or audio descriptions?
For sure.
I think it can depend on you know, a lot of games now doing performance capture.
Yeah.
Like Uncharted did, Last of Us. A lot of times with games, if it's not a performance capture game, you're alone when you're putting, like with Destiny. I've had one session where I got to work with one of the other actors on that, but that was just a random session, and it was just scheduling more than anything. It wasn't for anything other than the fact that, you know, the time they could be there was that day, and that was my time as well. So, but animation is sometimes can be a
group ensemble, yeah. Or you could be by yourself.
Yeah. So that's for me. It's always been the biggest thing. It's just that sometimes it's a lonelier job. Unless it's performance capture, which is just like shooting television or film.
Yeah. Only the wardrobe's slightly different.
Yeah.
But slightly different.
But you wear that anyway.
I do.
It does.
I think it compliments my figure.
Make it look good.
What else?
You guys touched on performance capture as being a growing part of the games, and people like Andy Serkis have moved from film into doing computer
games. Who's this now?
Never heard of him. British guy. Hasn't done much. Have you guys ever thought about taking your performance capture experience into movies? Could we have seen you in the Planet of the Apes films at any point?
You could have.
But they didn't cast us.
It was funny, a buddy of mine was in the last one, and I was like, have fun wearing the suit. And he was like, I have questions. Because it's something that comes very, it's kind of second nature to us now. Like, everybody gets hazed, and there's no one game that has done it one certain way. Like, yeah. Everybody has their own way of doing it. But there's some basic fundamentals about it. But it's the thing that I love about performance capture is number one, like you said, we get a chance to actually work with other people as opposed to just being in such a vacuum. But it really forces you as an actor to strip away everything that normally helps to inform you about the role. Like, I had a buddy that was on a film, and he's like, I don't feel like the character, but then I'm in the hair and makeup, and they give me the scar, and they put on the wig, and then I go and I get my wardrobe on, I have my sword, and it's like, then I feel like the character. And I go, let me tell you what it looks like when we go through all of that. And it's, you know, someone's putting, you know, 64 dots on your face, and you've got a camera and a helmet that has a camera right here, and you're wearing a leotard, you know, with little ping pong balls on it, and the other person that you're talking to, that you're in the scene with, is wearing the exact same thing, and you have to have all of that disappear because you're doing this incredibly intense. As games have, the writing has evolved, as the caliber of the kind of cinematic performance feel that they're trying to go for has evolved. You're doing a really, especially in the case of like The Last of Us, you're doing a very intense dramatic scene, and all of that has to go away. And so a lot of times people that come in from TV or film in a traditional sense come in and they lock up and they're trying to get over that hurdle of what normally has helped set them up for success is actually now a hindrance. But the long and short of it is this, it's always fun to watch someone who hasn't done this before, and you see that light bulb moment for them like we've all had, and it's like, this is what we did when we were kids. This is playing pretend, this is my gun, and this is, you know, me playing in a sandbox, just on a much, much cooler scale.
Yeah, and ultimately it comes down to that connection you have with the other actor. You know, it's all, you know, it's a relationship that you're, so I remember Gordon Hunt, who directed the first three Uncharted, would always talk about being very specific with that person you're talking to, same way as you would in on-camera situation. You know, so it's building the character like some actors like to do. Alec Guinness was famous for building character from the outside in. You know, if he was a king, he would wear the, you know, he didn't feel it till that cloak. So, but like you said, without that cloak, how do you do it? Alec Guinness, I'm sure he would have figured it out. But ultimately, it comes down to that, you know, just playing with that relationship and really finding the specifics. So, and Gordon Hunt used to really push that a lot. He said, you know, be specific when you're in your things. No extraneous movement, because especially in a digital space, it becomes a little more exaggerated.
I love being surprised, like when I like watching Rick and Morty.
Yeah,
right. And then all of a sudden, I'm just enjoying the episode, and then I hear his voice. Stupid voice.
Yeah.
One and of them. It's so much fun.
That was Pluto. Feel that? Just got a little smaller.
I'm Scroopy Noopers.
Scroopy Noopers.
Just got a little smaller.
It's stuff like that, and if we're playing a game or we're watching, like Fred Tatasciore is here, and the last three seasons of Family Guy, I've heard Fred in every episode. And especially when it's a friend, you get really excited and you feel like you're celebrating with them. It's like watching somebody run a 50-yard touch in the wrong place to make that joke. Except for the footballer. It's those kind of things that I love. But
keep going.
No. That's as far as I can take that metaphor. But it's to me, some of those really smaller, obscure roles are the ones that kind of... Every time, man, you're cutting your teeth. This is just my man. Every one of those small roles has somehow advanced you further. A buddy of mine, Glenn Morshower, said it's all about singles and doubles. It's about another baseball metaphor. Damn, I never make sports metaphors. But it's not about every time hitting it out of the park. It's about getting it on. I was containing within the metaphor.
He meant cricket.
Yes.
Nobody understands.
This is my life.
Brits don't even understand. Like,
he's like this when we're having lunch.
metaphor, dick joke. What we do.
And here it comes.
What else?
There it went. It killed me.
Talking about hitting out of the park, obviously, The Last of Us was one of those rare projects that really exploded and became a huge part of the landscape of video gaming. I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about how exciting it is to get to continue that with The Last of Us Part 2 and the pressure that comes with building off such a big hit?
There's a lot of that. I mean, we felt that pressure. I'll never forget the first time that Bruce Straley and Neil Druckmann walked Ashley and I through. We drove to the Culver Stages and we saw where we were going to shoot this thing, and they took us through the exact same pitch that they took Sony through to get the game greenlit. And about an hour later, they finished. And we're like, why don't we just take a break? And we walked outside, and I looked at Ashley, and I was like, do you realize if this thing fails, it's because of us? Because, they've got the pedigree, they've got the idea, it's all on us, too. And as you, 2.5 years of shooting, you realize, no, you've got a really good team of people that's going to make sure that you don't fail. They are your net to keep you. And the thing that I love about games specifically, and that game is a great example of it, is that it's not just one person that character rests on. It's the animator, it's the modeler, it's the shader, it's the coder, it's so many people that go into making a character in a game and making that game. But for The Last of Us specifically, coming back to it and you start asking yourself a lot of questions. You're like, do I have what it takes to do this again? Will people love it? And the beauty of being under the auspices of Naughty Dog and Neil Druckmann is that question is irrelevant, because we're not doing this so that people like it. We're doing this because it's honest. We're doing this because we believe we have a story to tell. And the second that we start trying to make something that we think you'll like, that's when we'll fail.
So, obviously you've been in a lot of roles throughout the years. Is there any been roles that you've thought that's really challenged you in terms of your vocal range and training?
I'm going to answer this question, but I'm completely responsible for it.
Yeah.
Whatever voice you audition with, they go, yeah, you get the job because of that. And I auditioned, there was one that I did for a cartoon for Nickelodeon called Breadwinners. And I was I was a Viking beaver. Unski.
And Unski talk like this, and everyone, it's just, but
26 episodes later.
actually, they were 11 minutes, so it was 52 episodes. And then they got a second season, so it's like 104 episodes. But he wasn't in all of them, but in a lot of them. But he also sang like that, what's that band, Gore?
Yeah.
So he had to, and then you do it, and oh, man, I nailed it. And then they go, that's great. Let's do it again, just a little louder, a little more. Okay. It's literally just one of those voices I will never audition with again, because it just was, you walk out like, thanks so much. It's just gone. So, but again, it's my if I can't sustain it, I shouldn't audition with it. So. I won't use that one.
Yeah, anymore. Never audition for a role you can't sustain. Yeah. Joker for me was the one, and it makes me look at what I mean. I already, people know this, greatly respected Mark Hamill for what he did because he is the Joker to me. But I watch him and I see how effortless it just flows out of him. Man, that's just not fair. It's really not fair because every session, if I could complete a 4-hour session, which typically I could not, I was covered in sweat and just I was exhausted. And typically, Amanda Wyatt, who was our booth director, would be like, "I'm going to go ahead and call it because we're starting to get diminishing returns." I'm like, "Yeah," because it's just such a it's the manicness and you start. The way that Mark never makes it sound like he's falling into a rhythm, but that he's always chaotic, to me is far cooler than what he does as a vocal quality, and that's infinitely cool. I will say this too, one last little closing thing, the BAFTA nominations were announced this week, BAFTA game nominations, and I'm incredibly impressed and glad that BAFTA was leading the way in the fact that all of their nominations were either a female lead or person of color. I think it's incredible. I think that it shows it's not someone motivating a political agenda, but it's responsive to what's happening in games right now. For that very reason, the fact that we have Shadow of Tomb Raider coming out, that's a strong female lead. We've got the last Uncharted was two strong female leads. We have What Remains of Edith Finch. You've got, I mean, all, yeah, him.
Drake, to a certain extent.
I'm excited to see what's happening in games because what it shows is that it doesn't have to be a square-jawed guy with a gun, and that opens up opportunities for us as characters to really explore with the role of not the protagonist, but maybe the villain or whatever else looks like, so...
What games are you playing? Find them, by the way.
I'm about to be stupid and jump into Fortnite because...
This was our Ready Player One episode. I feel like there could be so much more said, but I just want to go and play Joust. So let's do that. Ty, thank you so much for joining me here in the Cosmic
Always
Shed.
A pleasure. Oh, did you notice that Serenity from Firefly showed up at the end during the...
I didn't. I'm going to go and watch it again.
He jumps out and turns into... jumps on Mechagodzilla.
I'm going to go back and watch it again in the cinema if I can find it. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.